This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Before Rosa Parks, there was Pauli Murray. The often overlooked trailblazer was arrested for sitting in the whites-only section of a Virginia bus 15 years before Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat. Pauli Murray was raised in North Carolina, and her life is filled with firsts, which include being the first black woman to be ordained as an Episcopal priest. Her memoir, Song in a Weary Throat, An American Pilgrimage, was first released posthumously in 1987. Live Right Publishing just released a new edition with an introduction by Patricia Bell Scott. She is a professor emeritus of women's studies at the University of Georgia and the author of the award-winning book The Firebrand and the First Lady. That book details the relationship between Pauli Murray and former First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt. Patricia Bell Scott joins us now. Welcome back to the State of Things.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you, and whenever we have you back, you have to tell the story each time, but it's a good story to tell. Who was Pauli Murray?
Pauli Murray is a singular figure in American history. I like to say, along with a group of scholars who admire her, that she is the most important civil rights, women's rights figure, the most important a trailblazing Episcopal priest, and a very important writer, and she has been ignored. And I am absolutely delighted that this memoir has been re-released because it tells the story of her life in her own words.
Well, tell us more about her and her trailblazing. I mean, she tried to go to UNC Chapel Hill Law School and, of course, was denied application because she was black. That in 1938, right?
Yes, that's correct. And North Carolina looms large in Pauli Murray's life story. She was born in Baltimore, but reared in North Carolina with her extended family. She grew up living with her grandparents, and the childhood home there has become part of our nation's history. It was named a National Historic Landmark. And North Carolina was important because she went to primary school there. She was nurtured in a warm community and of relatives and an extended family of extended relatives, and she went to school there. And what was also really important is that Durham was full of role models. There was part of the community that was regarded as Black Wall Street. So she grew up where there were role models. And she also left there with the sense that she was an intelligent person, that she had a sense of agency. But because she was so determined, it was important for her that she leave a community, a situation which would not allow her to blossom in ways that she needed to. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that she needed was not to have to grow up in segregation. So she left North Carolina to go to New York to Hunter. North Carolina comes up again because after she finishes undergraduate school at Hunter, she wants to go to the University of North Carolina to graduate school. And unfortunately, at that time, the university would not admit black students. And so Pauli, which was her way, created a stink. She wrote the president of the university. She ran a campaign in the press to call attention to this unfair policy, this unfair white admissions-only policy. So in this book, in her memoir, she details both this wonderful childhood and the nurturing she got in Durham, but she also discusses the challenges she had with the University of North Carolina.
And before we're going to move on and talk about her accomplishments and the many ways in which she challenged authority and oftentimes successfully, we'll talk about that extended family. The women in that extended family here in Durham played a very important part in her upbringing and her strong sense of self and agency, right?
Correct. She was reared by a family of teachers. She was reared by her elderly aunts. They were her mother's sisters. They were both teachers. They were also movers in the Episcopal Church. I think there were some people, even people who knew Pauli as a young adult who were really surprised when she decided to go into the ministry, when she announced that she had been called. But that was part of her family history. This was a multi-generational legacy that she was responding to, so that going into the ministry as an Episcopal priest was something that was in many ways felt very natural to her. Not to do it meant that she was going against the grain. So she made that contribution. She was a pathbreaker in that she was the first African-American woman to be ordained as an Episcopal priest. She was the list of firsts is just tremendous. She was the first African-American to earn the doctorate in juridical science, the science of law, from Yale University. She was one of the co-founders of the National Organization for Women. And I think that's important because she is missing from sort of traditional histories of the civil rights movement, because that many of those histories focus on the men who were institutional leaders. But she has also been missing up until recently in some of the histories of the women's movement, because those histories have often focused primarily on white women. And Pauli's history, historical contributions to women are just so important. So she was one of the co-founders of NOW. She did important work as a legal activist, and it delights me that one of the people for whom she is an intellectual mentor claims her regularly, and that person is Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And they met when Pauli was on the board of the ACLU, and the justice at that time was a young assistant law professor at Columbia University and also working for the ACLU. And the justice has said several times that it was Pauli's early work on behalf of women's legal rights that served as a model for her when she worked for the ACLU Women's Rights Project. So Pauli's contributions to the law on behalf of women, as well as her contributions to the law on behalf of African Americans and people of color, are tremendous. I'd like to go back and claim Pauli as one of the unofficial architects of the Brown decision. When she was a law student at Howard University, she wrote a paper in a senior seminar that was so important that professors put it in the files, their reference files, and then used it as part of the foundation when they wrote the brief for the Brown decision, that really important decision in which the Supreme Court ruled unanimously to end segregation in the public schools.
Yeah, and I'm gonna stop you right there, because that story in itself, there are more as far as I'm concerned, dazzling first. I mean, the fact that she was one of the few female lawyers, and then black lawyers, not to mention important lawyers with a JD, who would then write this brief that would be picked up by the NAACP and ultimately successful in the Brown case. But we take one step back, because the NAACP at that time wasn't even certain whether it was going to pursue the equal part. Okay, they'll never put us together, but it will force the equal part. We'll force them to make equal education and remain separate. That was an argument within the NAACP, so it wasn't certain they were going to take that strategy. And here she is already in the vanguard of that, saying, oh, no, we have to be able to integrate those schools and be equal. And here's the brief. Here's how you do it, or co-wrote that brief.
And it had a major impact on Chief Justice Warren, because one of the things that Pauli argued in that essay is that we really need to look at the psychological literature and look at the impact of segregation on children. And in his majority of opinion, the justice talked about how concerned he was about the impact of segregation on children. So Pauli's argument was laughed at when she presented it in the classroom, but it had an impact on the justice a decade later. So I like to declare her an co-architect of the Brown decision. I think that is just tremendous. I also like to claim her as a writer who set the path for the style of memoir that we so value now. She wrote a family memoir that was published in 1956, Proud Shoes, which is the story of her family. And when that memoir was released, reviewers initially didn't know what to do with it because, you know, they said, well, this is supposed to be a family history, but it reads like a novel. And now what do we say makes for a good memoir? We want it to read like a novel. So she made a contribution in terms of what we like to see or what we value now in the modern literary memoir. And I think her contributions as a writer are now getting the attention that those contributions are being acknowledged.
Why do you think it's so long in coming, recognition for Pauli Murray, given the many accomplishments that she's had?
Well, I think there are multiple reasons, and I think they intersect. First of all, here she is, an African-American woman who is absolutely brilliant and an intellectual, and she is functioning in an arena, particularly when we think about law, in which the people who are the gatekeepers are primarily male, primarily white, and primarily well-heeled, even though Pauli comes from a family that is socially and culturally middle class. They are not wealthy people. So she is an outsider in the sense by virtue of her sex, by virtue of her race, and really by virtue of her economic background. She is, I think, often ignored for reasons I think having to do with her temperament and personality. This is a woman who does not suffer fools, and so she's impatient. She really has difficulty working within bureaucracies, and often the history and the chronicles of who is important are determined by one's attachment to important institutions. And though Pauli was a lifelong member of the NAACP, she had difficulty trying to stay and work with committees and groups within the association because the wheels moved too slowly for her. In addition, Pauli also had to deal with the stigmatization and the discrimination against her because she was unconventional in her personal life and her sexuality. She was woman-loving, and even don't know how much the leaders of the NAACP actually knew about her personal life, but there were always rumors about her relationships with women. And so she had to deal with the stigmatization of not being a conventional heterosexual. And she also had a much broader view of life and what she could do. She used to say, I want to live life in the fullest sense. And so that made her very different from her more conventional, lawyerly social peers. Mm-hmm. And so the combination of those factors, some of them being personal, but many of them, I would say all of them, converging into a sort of huge complex of discriminations because of sex, because of gender and sex identity, because of race, because of economic barriers, converge in a way that result in our not knowing about a woman I believe to be the most, one of the most important figures in 20th century American history.
That breadth, that depth, the scope of her intellect and her accomplishments was a problem for her when she came to writing this book. It took a long time for her to write her autobiography, didn't it?
Yes, it did, Frank. It took her 18 years. It took her 10 years to decide on the title. I mean, she was working and writing all along, but it took her 10 years to decide on the title. And the title, Sung in a Weary Throat, comes from a line in her epic signature poem, Dark Testament. I'd like to read just a stanza from that, if I may.
Please do.
It reads, hope is a crushed stalk between clenched fingers. Hope is a bird's wing broken by a stone. Hope is a word in a tuneless ditty, a word whispered with the wind. A dream of 40 acres and a mule, a cabin of one's own, and a moment to rest, a name and place for one's children and children's children at last. Hope is a song in a weary throat.
Patricia Bell Scott reading from Pauli Murray's poem, Dark Testament. We're talking about the new edition of Pauli Murray's memoir, Song in a Weary Throat. And Professor Scott has written the introduction to that. And talk about the way this came together and why. I mean, it was important to her. She spent a long time on the title. She understood that this would be the focal point and help focus her on how this book would be written, right?
Yes, yes. She chose that line because she felt like it indicated, it gave a sense of how much her drive for achievement meant, and also her sense of wanting to belong. And she spent a lot of time trying to figure out what the perspective would be. She had already written a family memoir, the story of her family, and she was initially confused about whether or not this would be an extension of that or whether or not it would simply be a book about her as an adult. And what she chose to do was to write a memoir with a tilt toward the social and political issues with which she was long engaged. So you see her as it begins a bit with childhood. The first six chapters focus on family, but the bulk of it focus on her life and her moving through the world as a change agent. And she doesn't talk as many of her generation chose not to do. She doesn't talk as much about the personal challenges which interest us and right. which I try to talk about in my biography of her. But she does give us hints of the struggles that she dealt with. For example, she had a thyroid disorder, and that would prove to be disruptive because it from time to time would precipitate mood swings. She would have periods of working to the point of exhaustion, and then that would be followed by periods when she just simply needed to rest for long periods. And there are hints, a few hints about that. She doesn't talk explicitly about her intimate relationships, but if you are a close reader, you know, you see it there because you'll see a warm vignette of her friend Peg Holmes and the portrait that she presents of her life partner, Irene Barlow, is just absolutely loving. So she doesn't say in the way in which we would as contemporary readers, this is my lifelong mate or my partner, but she shows us. She shows us in her description of their partnership. You see it in how she describes Irene. And she tells us a little bit about herself in her self-descriptions. She makes references to her preference to wearing pants. She makes mention of her preference for wearing her hair short and bobbed. She talks about who she is, but she does it in ways that are different than many of us would do in more recent, younger women, because by the time that Pauli finishes this book, she is in her mid-70s, and it is the mid-1980s. Were she writing now, she probably would write this differently, but it gives us a sense, and we need to understand, I think, how one negotiates the isms, the discriminations, the barriers that she had to deal with during the period in which she lived.
Patricia Bell Scott. Well, you know what? Mm-hmm. I sadly, and there's not enough time. Thankfully, there is now. Her home is a National Historic Monument in Durham, North Carolina. So maybe more attention will come to her. But I have to break now. Patricia Bell Scott, Professor Emeritus at the University of Georgia. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Frank.
She has written the introduction to Pauli Murray's memoir, Song in a Weary Throat. She's also the author of the award-winning The Firebrand and First Lady, and you can find all of that at our website, stateofthings.org. Coming up, a preview of the Carolina Blues Festival on the State of Things. Stay with us.